Welcome, welcome, guys. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In. We're on location in sunny Barcelona, very warm at the moment, although warm in Dublin where you are, Dara, so, you know, sort of the same weather maybe, but just heat wave affecting us in a different way.
Yeah, I just got off a call with my wife and she was complaining about the heat, but apparently it's only 25 degrees back in Dublin, but that's of course a heat wave in Dublin.
No aircon, that's the big difference.
No aircon, and also much more humid as well. So, yeah, I mean, I haven't found it unpleasantly hot here at all, I have to say, but then I have this unusual thing where, even though I don't like the heat, once I'm in a place a day or two, I'm actually fine with it.
Yeah, this isn't going to be about just the weather, guys. Don't worry, we are going to talk some poker. So we have been here for about maybe 5 days already. Well, I think Dara's been here 4 days and I've been here six.
Yeah. Well, actually, I got here late Thursday, so this is only Thursday, Friday.
No, it'll go out later. You can't tell exactly when it is. Suffice to say, it's before the EPT and it is after the Astraeus, or at least after our participation in the Astraeus. It may be playing its final table today in real time. It's been a really fun festival. Obviously, Barcelona is one of the great destinations for poker. I think we're delighted to be here again. And in this video, hopefully show you a few of the sites. We've been neglectful with some of the sites and some of our more recent on location. In fact, some of our on location lock-ins have not even been on location. We've just recorded them in our houses when we got back from the trips.
Yeah, that's kind of dependent on how the trip's gone. This one's going well enough.
Yeah, so we're doing good.
There's a little bit of enthusiasm yet.
Yeah, we realized very quickly that like we didn't do one from Vegas because we were so over Vegas and we weren't like making really nice deep runs all the time. Whereas Dara has been cashing everything so far. So then Dara was like, "Yeah, let's do it."
Yeah, and you had a deep run in the Astralis main event. Yeah, I mean on that Astralis main event, that was the first event that I played. Was it the first? No, it wasn't the first. You'd actually catch another event already, I think.
I played two. I played the 1K, which was a very much a locals field. It was sort of before the people really came in, because obviously people sort of target the Astraeus as their first event mostly. So I got in a couple of days early. I was given 1 week only by my missus. So in I came, played that one, built a little bit of a stack, but then bust well before the money. And then jumped in the hyper and managed to come 15th in the hyper. But that was like, you know, I built a big stack and I had heaps and I was probably the chip leader at one point, but then your chip lead about like, you know, nine hands later becomes an average stack and about five hands later becomes a really short stack and then it's all over.
I pretty much had that experience yesterday in the hyper, looking down at my stack well from the morning thinking this is already a well above average stack, when the bubble will burst, and of course then, yeah, like you said, 10 hands later suddenly I'm short and I'm shoving all in with king jack and I'm gone. I mean, that's fine, like the structures are supposed to be fast anyway inside events. It is a very good structure in the main event, and obviously the EPT main, which I'll be playing later, has an amazing structure. So
that's got a great structure, I love that one. Finally on the hyper thing, because you might notice that Dara and I have been squeaky wheels in the past about not playing those hypers because they rake them fully in the past, but credit to Stars, they listened to a bit of feedback. I know actually they took our feedback very much to heart.
Yeah, it would be... I guess I'm not supposed to say, I guess if Stars had told me that they changed it specifically because of what I wrote after Prague, that would be not nice, so I won't do that.
Needless to say, those blogs were influential, and I know Toby Stone in the team was certainly observant of that. He probably did spot that was the one maybe egregious bit of rake left in their schedule, and they did repair that. They now rake it at 5% plus the dealer fee, so much more fair for what, like 10 minute levels where you play three hands a level.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm honest, I think it's still maybe a little bit too high, because effectively it's a 960 plus 90, so it's almost 10%. Mm. But you're right, like it's not egregious. So
and you're a good tipper anyway, so you might have tipped the 4%.
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, I don't really do the tipping thing anymore because they take the 4% out, and I used to tip more than 4%. So they've lost out on people.
They've
like
lost
me,
on but, you, but they've but, gained on me because I was a 2/2.5% tipper.
Yeah.
So they've done well out of me.
Yeah. I also, you know, the dealers have had a couple of hard years as well, so you can't really begrudge them extra bit of money.
No, you certainly can't. Well, look, breaking down the main event, because I know a lot of people do like a few hand histories and stuff like that. Dara, you are the person I most send my hand histories to. Although actually this week it's been fun. I've been sending some to Jen Shahady. She's here playing the tournaments as well. So is Vanessa Cade. So they've been getting their chat boxes bombarded by the same hand histories from me. But I do like to send Dara when I have an interesting one, usually so that he can go, yeah, you left the game tree pre-flop. No, you left the game tree on the flop this time, Dave. Yeah.
Well, okay, this was a 5% open pre-flop, so we can get away with it.
Was it only 5?
Well, no. Actually, if it's the 7-6 hand, it's a 30%.
Yeah, so really early on, actually, I fired 3 bullets in the Astraeus. This was number 3. It was in the hyper leg, so that was like the 20-minute levels, I think, on the very last sort of chance saloon to get into day 2. And level 2 was big blind 200 with the 200 ante, obviously. And I opened 7-6 suited under the gun plus 2. And it folds all the way around to the big blind who defends. And the board comes queen of diamonds. Diamonds are my suit. 8 of hearts, 5 of diamonds. So I flopped open-ended and I flopped a flush draw. Not a straight flush draw, but still got a lot of stuff working for me there. And he checks and I decide to bet 70%, which I believe is solver-proofed. So yay me.
Yeah, yeah, very much solver-proofed. Obviously, there's so many draws on this board. There's 6-7, there's all the gut shots in the sort of Jack 10, 10-9 region. And so, like, our value hands would want to go big here to deny equity, or at least to charge people to draw. It's also a board where we won't necessarily always fire a c-bet. So it kind of makes sense to have a big bet or check strategy on this board.
Yeah, then the turn comes a deuce, black deuce, as I recall. So a very inconsequential sort of brickish card, you would think. And it checks to me again. Now, at this point, I think sizing up's really good because, you know, I would size up with some of my big value hands. And then obviously a hand like this seems like the right one to put in the mix as well. It sort of benefits from getting loads of folds at this point because, you know, I could get some maybe queens to fold sometimes to a very big bet, probably not, but I can get most of the other hands to fold, I think. So I go for 1.3x pot. Apparently solver's like 1.5x. So I was in the right way of thinking about this hand, but maybe I could have been even more aggro.
Yeah, well, like when it comes to bet sizing is always driven by what our value wants to do. And then we work from that to how many bluffs we should have given the sizing. Our value on this board does want to go large because there are so many draws there. Still, and that's a huge part of his calling range on the flop. He probably has far more draws actually than made hands, so that's kind of the part of the range we should be targeting. Also, I mean, even if he does have a value hand that he's hanging on with, there's a lot of river cards which will basically kill our action. So we want to get the money in now while we're pretty sure we have the best hand when we do have a value hand, and then the bigger we go, the more bluffs we need. When you go exactly pot, you need 2 value bets to every bluff, approximately. On earlier streets, it's a little bit complicated because a hand like your hand isn't a pure bluff. It can turn into a very good value bet. But then we should use our strongest draws, obviously. They're the very first candidate because a lot of good things can happen when you get bet big. We can get the immediate fold, in which case we won a pot with 7 high, which is obviously great. But if we get called, we can also hit the river, and then the pot's bigger. And we win even more when we value bet. So yeah, absolutely, this is good sizing.
Yeah, so nice kind of idea by me there to go with the overbet. Surprising outcome, something you don't often see. When you do overbet, your opponents tend to not raise you because obviously you are, like Dara said, polarizing to strong hands and weak ones, and therefore raising would really just remove your weak ones. Although, you know, maybe getting this quality of hand out would be a success for him, but he's never going to get me to fold something like this because it's too strong a draw. So when he makes this, I think my original bet was 3.5k on this turn. He makes 8k, so it's not even like a good size raise. It's kind of a really weird bet, to be honest. I was a little bit head scratchy going, okay, well, it does feel like he has a value hand here. It would be very strange for him to sort of like set up his own bluff with a sort of a, you know, anyway, it did confuse me somewhat, but I did sort of feel like it does feel like value, and I probably can't re-raise again and get him off it. So I thought, well, I'm just clearly getting a very good price now, 4.5k into this pot of like whatever, it's almost 20k it'll be at that point. So, you know, I need 20 something percent. I make the call and then the river comes a deuce, so it pairs the bottom card. Actually, I think quite an interesting card when you look at how this board has run out. And he checks. Now, obviously, does he bet here? I think I'm just having to give up. Like, I can't really make anything work. There's not much wiggle room. In fact, his bet could be all in, and then obviously with seven high, I'm putting it in the bin. But he checks, and that sort of opens the door for me. The pot is around 19.5k, and I think we had about 19-20k left in the hand. So once checked, I did think, well, this is kind of interesting. You know, obviously he could have some misdraws. He could have been setting up a draw himself. Once I called, maybe he just bottled and he just got a strength read off me. But I then can't just show down 7-9 because that's never going to be good. So I need to sort of get him off those hands anyway. But then I also thought about, like, well, maybe what value would he have done this with? And there was a reasonable shot he could have got counterfeited here, I thought. In his mind, had I got aces or kings, which I would maybe take this line with. So I figured, actually, I think I could make a believer out of this man and go for it. So I did, and he does fold, and he actually folded reasonably quickly. So it is almost like in his mind he figured he got counterfeited because he turned over the 8-5. So he had made, you know, sort of middle two pairs, you like, on the, well, flop bottom two, turn, it was became middle two. Obviously felt like his hand was good then, which it was and would be against my over pairs, but then would have got counterfeited. So he did get sort of spooked by that. I guess I did show a lot of strength in the hand. My draw was so big, I was able to show a lot of strength.
I think it was pretty trivial, to be honest, because he is beating absolutely nothing now.
Yeah.
I mean, even your queen X has counterfeited him, so it doesn't have to be aces or kings. I think he ran into the one hand maybe that folds, but in this spot, when checked to, you absolutely have to find bluffs, and this is absolutely the best bluff because we're right at the bottom of our range with no showdown. Even if we have something like Jack 10, it's kind of it's not going to happen very often, but it's possible that he actually has a worse missed draw, something like your hand.
Yeah, he could have a kind of a World's Fair draw of his own.
Yeah, but you have literally the worst draw on this board, so you have to bluff with it. And you were getting a lot of kudos from Vanessa and Jenna over this hand, and like, it did work, and I think you do have to bluff on the river for sure.
It's dicey though, like live poker in particular. I wasn't loving this spot, I'm going to be honest with you. I sort of felt like I had to put my big boy pants on here and maybe, you know, tell a good story consistently by the river. But don't get me wrong, I thought this was razor thin.
It is razor thin, and you do have to take your courage in your hand in those spots.
Did you just look down at my big boy pants there?
Unfortunately, he's not actually wearing any pants. So.
That's not true. I'll stand up. I have pants on for the audience. There we go. Shorts.
They're your big boy pants.
Well, they do look a little like schoolboy pants, but still, they are my pants.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I thought that was a really nice hand. And it was solver approved. His raise on the turn really doesn't make a lot of sense. Not at that size anyway. If he has like a set or something else, he should just go bigger and charge the type of hands that you have. Like, he gives you such a good price that you're actually getting the direct price, even if you're never going to bluff the river.
And I did feel like, because my line has a lot of value in it, like you said, Dara, it was weird that he checked back. Like, I didn't feel like he was trapping me with the boat. So I didn't think he had like pocket fives and would check there. Like, obviously it would have been perfect and would have worked against my specific hand, but I think he's meant to bet the pocket fives because he's meant to target my aces and my kings and maybe my really, you know.
I think you have a lot of draws in your range as well. You can have the diamonds, obviously, and you can have stuff like Jack 10 as well. So
sometimes his check isn't too bad?
I think his check would be okay.
With
boats, because also the deuce isn't really his card, so it's more of a blank. I think, you know, he can go either way on the river. He could bet, but it depends on whether he wants to target the value hands that have to call the bet but won't bet themselves, or the missed bluffs.
Well, the next hand, and I'm only going to tell two hands, and I'm conscious that we normally don't do hand histories in this, but it was just kind of a couple of interesting ones that got our heads scratching. Second one was from about maybe in my day one leg, I think it was like 150 were paid, and I think it was like 250 people left. The effective stack was mine. I had 22 big blinds in the big blind. It's a blindy blind contest, and my opponent limps into me. I look down at Jack 5 offsuit, and I just check back. Dara pointed out to me that that can make a sort of like one of my bluffs. It's kind of one of the hands that, like, you know, the jack, I have a bit of something going on for a raise, that if I do get call, I might be able to proceed having made some sort of okay hand. But also it just kind of works as like one of your trash hands that you can throw into a raising range.
Yeah, it's such a trashy hand. Like it does block some of the traps, you know, like ace, jack, jacks, etc. Mm. So it has, but it's such a trash hand that it's the kind of hand that if you're raising, get shoved on, you really don't mind folding. Mm. It's going to be in terrible shape against that range, so you might be actually saving yourself money. Mm. So it's one of those hands you're definitely supposed to mix. These blind on blind spots are really confusing because almost every hand is supposed to mix, and the ranges just end up so wide. And you know, stuff that we use in other spots, like blockers, really don't come into it, because when the range is super, super wide, a blocker doesn't really matter all that much. It'll be blocking much less of the range. And then the stacks are so shallow as well, it gets really confusing.
Yeah, that's a really good heuristic there to bear in mind regarding the wide ranges and the blockers. Nice from there, Dara. So, I do actually just check back here in this spot, and we go to the flop. The flop is King, King, 8, Rainbow. My opponent fires one big blind, the minimum bet, and I call. Little sticky already, little maybe solver not proved already. I know this one's pretty close because you obviously can be good with Jack High. A fair amount, but you know, it is sort of playing with fire already. We're sort of, you know, we're hanging off the game tree, maybe. We're just dangling off a branch.
Yeah, it is fine. I did look at this in the solver, and the solver mixes it. If we always call this hand, we're calling too much, which is not surprising given that we have two Chulapin here. But if we always fold this hand, which I would have done, I have to say, then we're folding too much, and people can exploit us with these limp stab lines.
So you're saying what you want is a fusion of the two of us, Dara?
A fusion of the two of us, yeah.
You want a chip race approach.
Yeah. Yeah. The reason I would fold in this spot is that just we have so many better hands. You know, we have stuff with backdoors. We have, in fact, any suited hand that isn't the missing suit on the board will have a backdoor flush. We have backdoors around the 8, stuff like 10, 6 even can hit a straight. Jack 5 is just a little bit wider. And yeah. It's like no matter what we hit, we're not going to win a very big pot. So in a tournament, while recognizing that I'm overfolding by overfolding this, I would always fold this hand.
Yeah, no, it seems pretty reasonable. Obviously, I didn't do that, though. Turn comes a 6 of spades. It brings 2 spades. I think one of the kings was a spade. So that's King, King, 8, 6, 2 spades. Now he bets 40%. So, you know, little size up compared to his flop bet, but kind of more or less in the same ballpark as his flop bet, that sort of one-third-ish type of size. And again, I get sticky. Now, this is probably where whatever like little twig of the game tree I was dangling off, I've now fallen to the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a pure fold. I mean, this is a garbage call, really. But
garbage call, everyone.
In solver world, in expert world, against somebody who might be over bluffing, then you can always justify it. But I find these spots.
Oh, and I will do
it. I find these spots annoying because, like, when you say to somebody, "Well, this is a fold," and then they go, "Yeah, but this guy's over bluffing," it's like, well, then you can justify pretty much every call.
Do you hear that, guys? You can justify every call.
Call everything, but. Yeah, I just don't understand this call, really. I just don't see. Again, we have so many hands that have improved.
So rich.
And
so
this rich. Is this is not one of them. And this is a hand that even if we hit the river, we're not going to be able to value bet with confidence.
Gets worse, guys. Gets worse.
Yeah. I mean, his size is interesting because most of his betting on the turn should be at a bigger size. Most of his King X wants to bet big so that they can get all in on the river. But then I think he does have some weaker hands like the 8 and maybe some 6X as well. You know, if he started bluffing with something like 9-6 because of the back doors and he's hit a 6, he can do this small bet as well. So I think then he should obviously be protecting the range with some King X. King 6 would make a perfect one because that would block the board so hard. So he's kind of basically saying, I either have nothing, I have a weak hand that I don't want to put a lot of money into, but I still think I can get value with, or I'm protecting that range with a king. And I just don't see the point in hanging on with Jack 5 again. I know I'm repeating myself here.
No, so anyway, completely disregarding Dara's post-mortem advice, didn't get it in game, so, you know, because that would be cheating. So I just, you know, went with my own instincts here and did go for the call. Obviously, I'm in a super dicey place right now. And the river comes an ace. So it's an offsuit ace, so it doesn't complete the backdoor flush. And now he bets 65-70%, something in that region. I think it was like 68%. And that was a head-scratching bet for me because I sort of expected him to go large or very blocky.
Yep.
And I was really weirded out by the middly size. The middly size sort of confused me and actually made me really kind of emboldened that my read all the way through while completely leaving the game tree might be onto something, and this guy might be a scallywag, to use a phrase that you've used a few times this week to speak
not,
about.
Not a scallywag in Barcelona this weekend.
I thought it might be scallywagging, and I did put in the call. Now, I know once we completely leave the game tree, there's almost no point in doing any sulfur-based analysis anymore. So maybe just wing it or hit me with something, Dara. I don't know what you do at this point.
This is a very confusing size. He's not really supposed to use this size. Exactly as you said, he's supposed to either go very big and polar with his king X and his best bluffs, or he's supposed to bet a smaller blocker size with hands which can get value from worse, but can't get value from a big bet. So those are supposed to be his two sizes. This size doesn't really make any sense. If we look at what we're supposed to do against those two sizes, like Jack 5, if we have it in our range, wouldn't even be a call against the small size. So against the bigger size where we're supposed to fold more, that suggests we should be folding it even more. Against the smaller size, our queen highs mix. Some of them call, some of them fold, some of them turn themselves into bluffs. So I guess queen five is the closest hand we could look at to jack five. And queen five either folds or turns itself into a bluff against the smaller size. So it doesn't think it has enough showdown. So I think if I was considering continuing, I thought the guy was scallywagging, I would actually raise here.
Just in case.
Right, yeah, because he could be bluffing with a better hand. He could have something like Jack 10 or a queen, which he's now turning into a bluff. And we'll get all of those to fold if we raise.
So my only raise really would have been to go all in here. His 70% bet type of thing represented about... it probably meant that half my stack was in already, so to put the other half would have been the logical remaining bit, and maybe could have done it that way, but I didn't. I went for the like really thin call and hoped that my read on the situation and the dynamics was good, even though I knew I absolutely acknowledged this was street poker and I had sort of left any fundamentals behind a few streets back. And fortunately for me, he did have 9-3 off, which actually means that he might have played the hand even worse than me. That's the one consolation I took.
Absolute pure scallywagging, yeah. I mean, his bet on the flop's probably okay. The limp stab is reasonable.
Mm.
But he has so many better continues, and then his sizings are just weird as well. These spots, like, we can look at them in solvers and say, well, this is a garbage hand. But, you know, if you have a very strong read, it's fine to go with it as well. Anytime your intuition is trying to tell you something, trying to get the message through that, look, I know this is never a call, but maybe we should think about it in this spot. My experience is that more often than not, you'll be right in those spots. So, you know, trust your read if you have one, and you obviously read the benefit in this hand.
Yeah, and I think probably on balance over my career, I've been a reasonably good reader of the game. I always feel like it's a very dicey situation because you can, if you ever let yourself believe that you're like a sole reader and too great at that aspect of
the game,
you really open the door to give yourself justification.
There is a danger because this is a sample size of one as well. Like, he literally turned up with a 9-3.
Yeah.
A lot of worlds he's going to turn up with a king. A lot of worlds he's going to have a pair. A lot of worlds he's going to have a queen high, and we're going to feel really, really.
That's going to be the dirt. Maybe he'll muck the queen high for me. Maybe he'll muck the queen high, and that's the only way I get that one through.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was the story of sort of how I made it kind of up to bubble-ish territory, got through the money fairly handy, actually built a little bit of an above average stack. I got fortunate enough, even though I didn't have a particularly big stack at the bubble, but I was covering most guys at the table. I think I covered all but one. We were just all quite short. So I did manage to chip up a little bit around the bubble, got to about 280K. Dara, I think you were sort of like rocking maybe 100K around this period across the room from me. And then once day two got going, I just never got going, to be honest. I just stayed in the 16 to 28 big blind zone for the entire day, never left it. But I thought in that was kind of a lesson, Dara, because this is something we talk about a lot. We obviously feel like we're in our wheelhouse, sort of 30 bigs and below. It's sort of where we play 95% of our poker as tournament guys, particularly tournament guys online. So you kind of have your fundamentals. Appreciate that I left my fundamentals behind in one particular hand. We do have good fundamentals on that kind of stack. And I always feel like there's almost a lesson in this one that a lot of people think, oh, you just have to spin up. You have to spin up, get back to 50 bigs, get all your weapons back, get all your 3-betting and 4-betting stuff going. And I never feel that way. I always kind of feel like, you know, in an effort to overplay hands, to try to force myself into that zone, which is not even a zone where I probably play as well, if I'm honest. I probably play the shorter the stack, probably the more optimal I play. So I always feel like, well, it's just fine. You can just play 25 big blinds and get your couple of raises through, get your reshove through, and just keep at 25 bigs. Even though the blinds are going up, you can stay at around that blind level for days. I did it in the main event last November for like 2 days. I think it's something that maybe is a tip for you guys out there, that don't get panicky when you're in the 15 big blind zone, 20 big blind zone. Don't feel like you have to get back to the average stack, whatever it happens to be. Just play the cards that come to you. You might get the double up and get back anyway. But
I always feel better when you have that sort of stack anyway. Because I know you played very well, and when you have lots of chips, as you had, for example, in the equivalent event at Prague, I'm like, oh, it's probably not even going to cash, which is also what happened, incidentally. Rightly or wrongly, and this might be unfair, but I do feel you can get a little bit spewy sometimes when you have 100, 120 big blinds.
Oh, I would totally agree with
and
that.
And you start thinking you can push people around. Yeah. And poker doesn't work like that. I mean, if they all have 20 bigs and you have 120, you're still playing 20 big blind poker. And if you're playing too wide and trying to push people around, they will actually end up exploiting you fairly badly. So so that's another tip. Like, this is why I always tell my students, like, study 40 big blinds and under, because that's where all the important stuff is played. It's all very well when everybody has 100, 200 big blinds at the start, but even if you win a 10 big blind pot, that's still only 10% of a buy-in in value. All the value comes later when the big money decisions are being made in and around the bubble and then deeper into the money.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, we got to the end of the day. We bagged up day two with a below average stack, but pretty healthy. It was kind of in a good spot, to be honest. I think I had maybe over $1 million. And then day three started quite well, to be honest. I managed to get up to $4.5 million quite quickly. I would actually describe day three as quite a card dead day, but crucially, the two premiums I had, I got full double ups both times. So that's a kind of a run good right there, is that, like, I got the value when I had it. I think I had kings hold against ace king. I had queens hold against fours. And then I ended up on Andy Wilson's table, actually, for a lot of day two. He was in the field still in day three. He's a fantastic player. Shout out to Bowie Effect. He put me in the bin a couple of times. I was very conscious of not opening into his big blind with the same range that I normally would, because I did feel like he had a big post-flop advantage against me, and I didn't want to put myself in that situation. I also got to play with Jack Sinclair, good friend of the show's. Jack was on my direct left, actually, when I bust. I arrived to his table with maybe 50 to go. I bust in 26th. He was actually one of the short stacks at the table when I arrived. And by the time I left, he was one of the middle stacks. And when I looked around half an hour after busting, I think he was the chip leader.
Yeah, I think he just won lots of flips, to be honest. Look, judging from the Instagram story, I did chuckle when I saw you guys side by side, because I'd been talking to Jack at the previous break and he'd been moaning about his table draws, saying they were all terrible. He arrived on day one, he recognized six of the people at his table. Then that table broke and he was like, oh, great. And then he moved to the next table and it was even worse. And in his words, he said, like, they were all real pros, like they were proper pros. There were no even plastic pros like Lappin. He specifically pulled you out as the example, and then of course you got moved to his table. So
yeah, well, he didn't get much trouble out of this plastic pro. I have to be honest, I ended up just losing two flips, king queen suited against ace jack, for, like, he was the short stack. I think he had like 10 or 12 bigs. That was a chunk out of my stack. And then the second one was ace eight suited against sixes, again just a pretty standard situation. Managed to get some ladders up to I think an 18k with some change score, but I'll be honest, and Dara will testify to this, it's a sombering kind of moment. Like, and don't get me wrong out there, guys, because I know a lot of people, like, a 20k score would be like up there with your best scores. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there where it might be your buy-in too. But, like, when you do get that deep in a field that big, like, bear in mind 6,400 runners or something, the largest ever field has been assembled for a European poker tournament in history. When you get into that sort of last 35, and I was about average with 35 to go, you are starting to let a little dangerous bit of hope or whatever glimmer in.
Yeah, you look up at the screen and you see that 600,000 prize all the time, and you can mentally start
spending
it and imagining what you're going to do with it. I mean, I'd already mentally worked out how much of that was going to be mine as well. So yeah.
42k.
I was suitably disappointed. Yeah, it is one of those things because it's all about framing. Like, if this was back home in something like the IPO, a 20k score would be amazing, and you'd be really, really happy with it.
You probably came second or something.
Yeah, but when you do see that 600 up there, and it's not just that number, but like the other numbers for second, third, and fourth are all very big numbers as well. Mm-hmm. Then by comparison, the 20k does feel a bit of a anticlimax. But you kind of have to remember that, like, even when there are 35 players left, like, and your average stack, and you know, you're only supposed to win 3% of the time anyway. So. It feels a lot closer than it actually is. That's the way I'd say it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think once, you know, the dust settles and you've had a sleep, you wake up and kind of go, okay, I'm a little bit richer and that's nice. And I definitely don't want to be complaining about having a nice score. But a few crossbars in my last 12 months, it's fair to say. I think I've gone very, very kind of like last 0.5% of the field deep in some of the biggest fields I've played. Yeah. And then, no entitlement here. I don't deserve to, you know, get to the top 40 and then, you know, go on and get top 10 any more than 1 in 4. And I probably had 4 of those. So on average, you're probably not even going to have one. So it's pretty fair how it's happened. But it just feels tantalizingly close at the moment.
Yeah, because if you kicked on in one of those tournaments, that's obviously a much better result
than the 440s.
Than the 440s, unfortunately. But yeah, it is what it is. That's just the way tournaments work.
Zipping across now, I want to talk about your participation in the seniors event, one of the many tournaments you've cashed this week. Dara, you said that there was some elder abuse. Was that the phrase you used?
Elder abuse, yeah. The bubble was a very weird scenario because we'd already been playing for 14 hours. And, you know, the Stars traditionally advertises that they pay 15% of the field. So everybody had kind of worked out that it was 15% of the field, it was 61. And then a prize pool appeared that did confirm that 61 people were being paid. But then some announcement was made about the clock being incorrect. But to be honest, nobody really paid too much attention to it. And everybody at my table certainly thought that was the bubble. And we're playing accordingly. For example, I folded ace-jack with 62 left because I was short. And it was an ICM fold. Then the clock ticks down to 61 and I go over to our good friend Glenn, the tournament director, and say, like, why was there no hand for hand and are we in the money now? He's like, no, we're only paying 55. I don't know where the 61 figure came from. And I went back into my table and they were quite shocked. And then Glenn went around telling everybody, yeah, we're playing down to 55. And people were really losing it because I think they'd all mentally not just bagged the cash, but they'd also mentally bagged that we get to go home and sleep now after playing for 14 hours. And yeah,
and remember, these guys are more than 50 years old.
All more than 50, yeah. some a lot more than 50. And they were like, and we're expected to be back for 12 midday tomorrow, and it's already 2 a.m. and this bubble could go on until 5 a.m. So yeah, there were a lot of very unhappy people, and
they were all saying that their oatmeal was already poured in the house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like this is Twilight Zone. Like, they're never awake at this hour, and they told us, well, okay, yeah. I mean, I guess 12. If it ends at 5 is a bit too much, so we let you back at 12:30, in the end we did end up coming back at 1, which was fair enough. And actually the bubble didn't last very long at all. I mean, I sent David a message saying I'm the shortest and this bubble could take ages, but I forgot about the fact that about half the field in this, as in most tournaments this week, was French. So these people don't get scared about bubbles.
No.
Two guys got in hands that they definitely shouldn't have got in given the bubble situation. They both busted. And
did you say it was like ace-7 and jack-queen and they were two of the bigger stacks?
Yes, that actually wasn't even the bust out hand. But on my table, a guy who had been chip leader about an hour before and was clearly monkey-tilted, shoved far too many big blinds under the gun with ace-queen. Bard Dahl, who I had great chats with at the table,
Chaired Bard.
He broke the bubble with jacks, but actually somebody busted on another table with an even worse hand, apparently. Going for it, as it were.
Yeah, going for it being the team. Finally, there was one funny incident. A little bit tight between the tables, fair to say. You know, in fairness to Stars, they had to play 10-handed. in a couple of the tournaments early on. They usually made a pretty good effort to get it down to 9 and down to 8 like they normally do. I think players will accept a bit of 10-handed when, you know, clearly they're trying to get numbers in the room, but it doesn't make for particularly pleasant levels of closeness to one another. You'd be even closer to me and Dara are in this frame.
Yeah, like...
And then on top of that, to get as many tables physically into the room, which they're doing as well, the backs of chairs are basically in contact with one another. So if you're trying to, when you bust out, it's actually normally like a game of Pac-Man, trying to figure out a route to get out of the building. When you're upset that you've just lost your stack and now you have to like squeeze by people with your bag and whatever. So that is a scenario that's not very pleasant. But one thing you have to do in a poker tournament is you have to move tables sometimes. You get moved because you're in the big blind. You have to go to the table that has a couple of empty seats, or you have to, you know, break your table and off you go traveling. And again, you're having to somehow get through these little narrow gaps. And I believe a guy arrived to your table and something rather unfortunate happened.
Before I get onto that, I have to say I felt I was okay with how close the tables were together until they pulled away the curtain from the stage area and they revealed that there's a massive blank area in front of the feature table. It's like
the feature table is taking half the room.
They could definitely have got some more tables in there. So that's what. But anyway,
make your studio just a tiny bit smaller, so it's so ostentatiously massive, and then we're all crammed.
Yeah, so we have an empty seat on our table, and I see the table over there breaking, and I see the players starting to spread out, and they're all doing the Pac-Man thing of trying to get to their new table. So I see the guy who's probably coming to us, and he's going like...
Yeah, but it looks like he knows that he's about to be the big one, and he's dodging it because he's doing it.
Yeah,
but he's
just trying to get through. So he arrives over, and he looks fairly tilted, it has to be said, and he's holding a fairly shorty stack. So you immediately get the sense that he's just taken a bad beat, which unfortunately he's going to tell us all about. because that's what you do when you've taken a bad beat on your last table, and then the table breaks immediately before you even get the chance to get your chips back off that country took all your chips. But anyway, he comes over.
Sorry, can I just put out a C-bomb? Dara allows himself one F-bomb per season of the show, and he's just dropped the C-bomb on the lock-in.
So he arrives over, and he's holding his chips like this, and he's looking around, like he's lining us all up to tell his story, and he just drops his rack nonchalantly on the side of the table, and it kind of bounces, and the chips just spray in every direction. they're rolling, and remember how close together the tables are again, so he's now gonna have to go, and you can literally see he's going again.
Where are they?
There's too many different directions that he has to register. There's one there, there's one there, there's one there.
So William Cassou's putting his foot over one over there. I did say that.
Yeah, so he moved from tilt, and I'm about to tell a bad beat story, to now I need to reassemble my stack. There were people like six tables over who were going, there's one over here, there's one over here. So, I mean, people were very honest, to be fair, in general. He was probably lucky.
Crawling around his hands and knees trying to get
But he was getting under tables and stuff, yeah. It was quite amusing. It was not a very dignified way to enter your new table, so I wouldn't recommend it.
Well, look, on that note, guys, it has been a quick one, but we are on location here. Dara is heading off to play the 2K High Roller today. I'm actually leaving Barcelona. As I said, I was given a one-week trip. No EPT for me this year. I'm a bit gutted about that because it is the best EPT, to be honest. A couple of the EPTs are properly tough tournaments, it must be said, but there are a couple that are really good. Barcelona and Prague stand out, and I did really want to play this one. But c'est la vie. I will be back at my desk in Malta railing you all week, Darren. I'm going to be getting the hand histories from you as you progress through tournaments, because we do reciprocate. He sends them to me too, not because he wants my opinion, but just because he just wants to send them to me. But usually a brag about how well he played, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the EPT, obviously. And there's a couple of other good tournaments on. There's a couple of mystery bounties, which obviously is the new format that everybody's getting excited about. And I can only imagine how manic a mystery bounty in Barcelona is going to be. So looking forward to that as well, if I don't progress in the EPT. That'll be sort of plan B and C. But hopefully I'll be deep in the EPT and have to reschedule my flight on Saturday.
Yes, well, I'll be hoping that will happen. I might even schedule a flight back over just to watch the final table if you make it. On that note, guys, I want to say thank you very much for tuning in this week. Quick Unibet news before we go. Obviously, those satellites, the Unibet Open, are absolutely crushing it. They put it up again. I think like 5 or 6 seats guaranteed every week. Now, we usually guarantee 3. The fact that we're now getting 7, 8 people in every week tells me that we're going to have the biggest ever Unibet Open Malta. I don't know if we'll break the Unibet Open Bucharest numbers, which is our record, but Malta is going to be a huge, huge event for us. It's going to be at the end of September. There is a mystery bounty. Very importantly for us, Dara just mentioned mystery bounties there. The Chip Race mystery bounty is going to be the main side event. So if you do bust the main, you can jump into that one. We are at the moment knocking on the door, breaking down the door at Unibet to ask them to put some satellites to the Chip Race mystery bounty on the schedule. I think they're going to do that in the next couple of weeks. So if you've won your seat already to the Unibet Open, you can win this. If you, well, again, this is something I have to clarify, but I'm pretty sure if you're still in the main, you can have it as cash or tourney dollars. You won't have to, it won't be a lost buy-in. But if you do bust the main, you can have already won your side event satellite, which is nice as well. It means you go out to the trip and you don't really have to spend any money, which is always a good thing. Anyway, on that note, guys, thank you so much from Barcelona. This has been Daryl Kearney and David Lappin and The Lock-In.
Yep. A lot of fun, and shout outs to Jackson, Claire, and Andy on the final table.
No, Andy bust 11th.
Did he?
Yeah, sorry Andy, but good luck, Jack.
Yeah.
Whoops.
I was about to say we would normally be cheering for Jack, but we both decided we're not cheering this time because he's already insufferable and he's going to be absolutely unbearable if he wins this.
Oh, it will be hard to live with, won't it? And we'll probably have to invite him back on the show a third time, and he'll...
Completely botched the sending then. So Andy, who I was going to be cheering for, is gone, and Jack, who I'm anti-railing now.
Not really, Jack. Not really. We love you. Goodbye, guys. So Darren and I just had brunch over there. Very nice little spot. Darren found it. Got 4.7 on Yelp. After we're finished with it, it's going to be 4.71 because I will give it 5 stars. Very good. Well chosen. So people often ask us the question, you know, what do you guys talk about? Like, it's fair to say we do spend a lot of time together and we probably run out of things to say mostly.
Yeah.
Once we finish with the hand histories, of course. So today I asked Dara over brunch. Well, actually, first of all, we talked about children's television of the 1980s, specifically Irish made. But we got a good half hour out of that.
Half hour, yeah. And your mum used to be one of the big shows.
Shout out to my mum. And after that, inspired by an article Dara was reading about insults and curse words and the origin of them, we decided we would write down. We're very sad. We decided we would write down the, in my case, the 5 mildest insults I could think of. They're just like gentle. And then Dara would write down the 5 worst ones that he could think of for me, which I'm very frightened what he might say to me now. Okay, I'm gonna go first. So Dara, may you be badly positioned on a windy day. Gentleness, that's no, you're not offended by that.
I can live with that, yeah.
It's okay.
May you get the red diarrhea at a table when you're bluffing Christoph Vogelsang.
Okay. Dara, may this be the time that you need to input your 4-digit code on your credit card. No one likes that. It's never very pleasant.
May you spend an eternity at the life poker table of William Kasuth's.
Nice. May the waiter take away your drink when you had a little bit left at the bottom.
May all your tables have Bring Kenny and his horses.
That's probably all the tables online. Dara, may the dealer button be drawn 2 seats to your right. So I threw in a poker one.
May you end up co-authoring strategy books with an illiterate simpleton.
And finally, Dara, may your poached eggs be slightly overcooked. You're okay with that?
Yeah.
That would really piss me off. I thought that I saved that one for last because I thought it was gonna be the worst.
One.
Oh, a hard poached egg. No one needs that.
I'm not sure I even noticed. Finally, may you spend an eternity in a room in Bally's with Jonathan Little.
Oh, and unfortunately that is going to lead to an exhaustive exchange of emails for our bosses at Unibet.